We'll start then with Jim Wydilla, who is the marketing director at the Volo Auto Museum, as we learn more about Volo today. Welcome back, Jim. How are you today?
Good. Thank you for having me.
I was just reading the history of the... And by the way, do they still call it the Volo Auto Museum? Because I wondered if, since it's expanded so much over the years, it's more than that. You still call it that, right?
Yeah, about 3 or 4 years ago, you know, the meat and potatoes of the business is still the car sales, and still, you know, at any point in time, we have 200 to 300 classic collector cars. So that's still the meat and potatoes, but because we've added Titanic and dinosaurs and boats and planes and trains and carousels and rides, it was more than just an auto museum. We thought that you know, people that weren't into cars might be turned off by that, so we just cut it to Volo Museum.
The Volo Museum. But it did start out, well, just kind of give us the brief history of this.
Sure. It started out as a family business in 1960. This is actually our 65th anniversary this year. It started out with just a resale shop and a couple of brothers tinkering and fixing and flipping cars. And now fast forward, it's still the same family owned. We have no corporate sponsors or grants or fundings. It's all self-funded with the profits of both the admission of the museum and the car sales. And it's still now, you know, fourth generation, still owned by the Grahams family, and it's just expanded. It started, you know, the car sales, like I said, has been the meat and potatoes for many years, and that's where we really got world famous for. We have customers all over the country, and we sell about 1,000 cars a year. But now there's just so much more now that we've added the movie cars and added, you know, so many more mechanical marvels and pieces of history that there's really something for everybody. We have a 300-vendor gift shop. And, you know, cotton candy machines and an ice cream bar and just lots of stuff going on for all ages, because the car guys are great and it was great to bring them. But when they brought their families, they were miserable. So we wanted to make sure that we had something for all ages to really spend the full day and enjoy, you know.
And the kind of cars that you do sell there are what?
They're pretty much American muscle cars, I would say, is kind of our niche. We have very few foreign cars or any cars newer than like 1985. 1980, 1985 is pretty much where we draw the line. But anything from, you know, your standard Camaros and Corvettes and Mustangs and Chevelles and 57 Chevys and, you know, all the fun stuff in between. We're actually right now, we have a 1960 Buick we just announced for the 65th anniversary. We're giving away a 1960 Buick that's in beautiful condition. It was also used in a movie called Right of Way, and Jimmy Stewart and Betty Davis drove that car in the movie. So that's kind of like encapsulating what we are and what we do. If you go to the site, I mean, it's updated almost on a daily basis of all the cool inventory that we have.
Do you flip the cars? That is, you take them in, clean them up, and sell them, or are you just consigning somebody else's already renovated cars?
That's how it started. We started fixing and flipping, and then at that next point, we started consigning because we had a lot of people coming to see the collection, and we couldn't keep up with it, so we started consigning and basically building a business off of other people's merchandise. Now we own probably 90-95% of the cars. We rarely consign them. We own them outright now, and as far as the restorations, because we sell so many and we move them so fast, we don't have time to sit on them for, you know, months and months, so we basically now just acquire cars. Jay Grahams, one of the owners, he just goes out, and now that we've been here for decades, we're pretty well known, so a lot of people come to us with either the restorations or cars that we've, you know, the original cars that they have, but we go to a lot of auctions and private collections and estate sales and things like that as well. So they come from all over the country and all over the world.
The last time I was at the Volo Museum, it was the Volo Auto Museum, and I was impressed with how affordable some of the cars were. Some of them aren't for me, but some of them were in the price range that I would expect to pay for a good used car.
Sure. Yeah, that's and for a while, I mean, you know, 20 years ago, those cars, you know, from the 80s and the 70s weren't really classic or collectors, you know. They were more used cars. They were high-end cars. You could buy some nice Corvettes and things like that, but now we've gotten to the point where we've really narrowed down, and these are collector cars. These are cars that, you know, most of our customers have been, you know, they're retired, and this is the car they've always wanted. This is the car they had when they were growing up. This is the car their dad had growing up, you know, and this is the car that they've dreamed of having in their body physically, whether know-how or just physically can't spend months and months in a garage on their knees or laying down fixing up a car. So they want to either get a car that's truly an original where the numbers match, or what they have now called resto mods. So they basically strip down a car, they do the restoration, but then they add things like power steering and power brakes and more
yes.
comfortable seats and
I'll
air conditioning and radios. And yeah.
You do know that the Titanic wasn't a car, right?
True. However, we have six vehicles. It's about $6 million worth of cars that were owned by people on the Titanic. So it's an interesting twist. There was one car that was on the Titanic. And in the movie where Jack and Rose go down and get to know each other a little bit better, that car was actually on the ship. And it went down with the ship. It's still at the bottom of the ocean. But the only other car, it was a French prototype. And we have the only other car in the world. So there's some. It's still, even though it's Titanic related, and the cars, there's one car on the Titanic. It's still a neat niche that we have that none of the other Titanic museums have.
And they are
true to our image.
Creative and expansive there. So there is the Titanic experience at the Volo Museum as well as acres of stuff and a day for everybody. Jim Wydell is the marketing director there. It's in Volo. Nice to talk to you today, Jim. Thanks for the heads up.
So much. Very nice to talk to you. Thank you so much for having me.
We're joined again by Bree Fowler, the senior writer over at CNET.com, with a few things to talk about. Let's start with OpenAI and its employees or former employees. What's the latest there, Bree?
Yeah, a handful of former employees are asking officials in Delaware and California to put a hold on OpenAI's transformation into a for-profit business from a nonprofit charity.
Why are they doing that?
Well, they're concerned that what could happen basically if ChatGPT and OpenAI, you know, that they're able to turn ChatGPT or another AI model into something that actually outperforms people. You know, this is kind of the doomsday scenario thing where, you know, it may not be as accountable if, you know, it's not for charity, you know, kind of nonprofit. If it's out there to make money, then maybe it won't be looking out for people as much.
Well, they're not talking about a runaway computer that is competing with or harming man, right? That's the doomsday scenario, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, they do mention that, but I think it's more about, you know, if it becomes a for-profit company, people need to make money. You know, they could have shareholders and investors that they need to please. And if you are, you know, in it for the money, maybe you're not in it for humanity as much as you would have been.
And while we would be okay with that sort of, motivation, were it any other kind of company, this is just a different animal, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely an uncharted territory here. No one's quite sure how far AI can go. You know, there's always the HAL, Terminator, Doomsday kind of thing. But, you know, what if it just becomes really, really good at what it does? And, you know, starts eliminating jobs, things like that, you know, that is not so far outside of reality that, you know, we will see shifts in the workforce and things like that, and ethics and need to play a role in the development of those kinds of technologies.
Apple and Meta were fined by the EU. And it's interesting that, if I understand correctly, the rules that govern software makers like them or internet providers, whatever the heck they are different in Europe than they are in the United States, correct?
Yes. The European Commission has different kinds of technology rules that deal with digital tech and privacy and things like that. So they have imposed a 500 million euro fine, which is about $571 million on Apple, dealing with its app store and not allowing apps to point to cheaper options that are out there for people. And Meta was fined 200 million euros because it was forcing Facebook and Instagram users to choose between seeing personalized ads and having to pay.
I wonder if that's, is that a lot of money to them?
Maybe not. I mean, it's a lot of money. It definitely is something that, you know, will show up on a quarterly statement. Is it business ending for them? Definitely not.
Yeah. Talk about Elon Musk for a second. He's walking away maybe from Doge in Washington, D.C. sometime soon. The stock has gone down. Actually, when he announced that, or the president, somebody announced that he was going to sort of minimize his footprint in the Capitol, The stock actually went up a little bit. What's the latest with Doge and Tesla and Elon?
Well, Tesla had a very bad quarter, which, you know, you could argue was going to happen whether Elon Musk was, you know, doing a lot of hands-on time with the company or not. It's been tough for electronic vehicle makers in general lately. Sales have kind of gone down. Demand has gone down. And, you know, to put it lightly, Elon Musk has become a very polarizing figure. And people aren't as keen to buy, a lot of people aren't as keen to buy Teslas as they used to be. So, you know, he just hasn't been there, you know, overseeing the company because he's been in Washington. And he basically said on a conference call with analysts that he will be back running Tesla. And I think that did kind of comfort the markets that, you know, his priorities are moving back to that.
I wonder if that's a reflection of the cars themselves or is it really just about Elon?
It's probably both. You know, the cars themselves, I don't think people they like Teslas or they don't. You know, something like the Cybertruck is for a special kind of person. But, you know, there was still a wait list for them up until recently. You know, it's not a question of Tesla's quality when you're looking at, you know, more of the normal kinds of vehicles. If it's something that you want, you might have already bought it. The tax incentives just aren't really there as much as they used to be for any kind of electronic vehicle. And, you know, the market is kind of, it's a lot fuller than it used to be. You know, Tesla did say that it still plans to roll out a cheaper version of its best-selling Model Y SUV in the first half of this year. People were happy about that because, you know, electronic vehicles, if you're not getting those tax incentives, are very pricey.
I'm surprised that you just said that there, at least until recently, was a waiting list for those trucks.
Yeah, I mean, maybe there still is. It's a limited quantity kind of thing, you know. I see them a lot on the street, though, here in New York, which is kind of surprising.
Yeah, I see them where I live and in Chicago, too. I wonder if the people that buy them have seen them. Okay, that was an editorial comment. It's nice to talk to you, as always, Bree. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
She's a senior writer at CNET. A regular guest on the Wintrust Business Lunch is Michael Miller, the economics professor. He's from Western Washington University. We met him first when he was a professor at DePaul University, and he joins us again on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Hi, Michael.
Good afternoon. How are you doing?
Really good. I'm intrigued by some of the things you might have to say about the value of a college education, but before we get to that, I did want you to at least give us some of your latest thoughts. Last we spoke, you were telling us about the tariffs, and you thought those were a bad idea economically and obviously politically. Have your thoughts changed at all, and what have you noticed or what's been happening since we last spoke?
No, they have not changed because I pretty much base my thoughts on, you know, economic theory and then empirical studies that show the effects of tariff. I do see that a lot of it, though, is related to Mr. Trump's negotiating style. I'm very hopeful that he will be using these in a very ham-handed way, it appears, actually, to get people to the table to negotiate where we will end up, say, a year from now, with lower tariffs across the board for our trading partners. Now, with China, they're playing hardball. So that one's going to be a tough one. But I think with Europe and India and Japan and so forth, I think we could actually make some progress that trade will be overall better. But you and I will have to pay a cost in the meantime while those tariffs go into effect.
And after they go into effect in perpetuity, as long as they're in effect, right? And what would that look like?
Exactly.
What are you talking about that would be most amenable maybe to the U.S.?
Well, one thing is the research has shown us that the industries which are being protected, say steel and aluminum, the employment there would rise and would remain more protected. But because you and I will have to pay more money for everything that's made with those products, we will have less money left over to do other things, say go out to eat or go to a movie or whatever. And therefore, the employment in those other fields will fall by actually more than we save with regard to steel and aluminum. So it will have a negative effect in the long run on overall employment. It will, of course, skew the prices, and is a tax. You remember that, of course, a tariff is a tax, and a tax is not exactly economically expansionary. A tax is contractionary, so it makes things move more slowly as opposed to faster. And I am a little surprised that Mr. Trump does not seem to talk very much. He's very much in cutting taxes, but he doesn't seem to see a tariff as a tax. He sees it as a political tool to change the way that people behave with regard to the trade picture.
Well, if you flash the tariff in front of other countries and companies and then rescind it, but you, as a matter of fact, get them to change some of their policies or pricing, then that's not a bad thing, right?
No, it's not. See, there is a chance that when this is all over, even though this has been very messy so far, we may say, "Wow, he had a long run view in mind, and that long run view was to get people to allow for more free trade, and we're all going to benefit from that. In that, our trading partners will give us more access to their markets, say agricultural markets or cars and so forth, and we will have to reciprocate, of course, and keep our tariffs low like they are actually to begin with." And so the other countries win and we win, because the world will be more efficient and we will be able to get the products that we want at a price which is not influenced by the tax called the tariff.
Smartphones have been excluded, though they're made in China.
Yes.
Maybe they have the baseline 10%, but they're not subject to the 145%. I saw a story mm-hmm. that said that the company that makes smartphones in China, in one massive plant, employs 300,000 people. It's a city dedicated to making the phones. And I only say that to say this. I wonder if that and textiles or anything else that comes back to the United States, athletic wear, do we have the manpower to do all of the jobs that the president is imagining?
Not tomorrow and not in 2 years, maybe in 10 years. It would be quite a process, because people would have to be trained to do those things. But more importantly than that, I mean, we could be training them while we're building, say, the factory. But building a factory, between the question of buying the land, getting the permits, getting it, you know, built and up and running, we're talking years. So this would be a transition that would take the better part of a decade. And a lot of damage, of course, can be done within that decade. So that's one of the – I know he really wants to bring – manufacturing back to the United States. But I think some of those jobs are simply gone forever, because other countries are better suited, what we call comparative advantage, to make those things than we are. And we should focus on what we do best. And between the two of us, then we have the most efficient use of our scarce resources. But no, we could not, even within, say, a five-year period, bring all those phone construction back here and textiles. And
well, and I saw also what a worker in Indonesia, India, or China makes. And I don't have the number in front of me, but it's hundreds of dollars a month. It's not tens of thousands
right.
of dollars a month. So
right.
I don't know how you're going to make a Nike shoe or the T-shirt I'm wearing at a price that I would be willing
right.
to pay if it were made in America by somebody making $20 an hour.
Sure. And there could be two arguments to that. One would be that the American worker would bring more productivity to the situation, so they could actually make more phones per hour than, say, somebody who's making that much lower wage, and therefore their higher wage would be justified by the bigger output. The second thing is, maybe do we really want to be buying cell phones that we are on the backs of exploited workers? Now, I know that that's an argument being made. I don't necessarily buy that. Because the workers, we have to realize that the workers in these other countries have a very limited labor market, say, compared to what we have. And so I'm not sure they're being exploited. But one way to think of it is, well, why should we be able to buy a phone? Because some person has to work at $20, you know, a day or something like that, when a more fair wage would be much more representative of what workers should be in terms of this, you know, the production process. So, the key would have to be the productivity, that somehow the American worker paid more would be able to make more phones per hour, which would justify the higher wage.
Well, I've seen the memes of a bunch of American workers on assembly lines, and I don't like our chances. And besides, a lot of these would probably be done by machines or robots anyway, right?
That's right. Anything which is repetitive, especially with AI, which can learn by its own mistakes, which is pretty amazing, some of these jobs are going to go away. So I'm not so sure it even makes sense to build a giant factory to build a product that's full of people when really what we need is a few people and a lot of machines. Could be an interesting future to have to make that tough decision on exactly how to set up the production process.
I'm going to take a break here, and then I'm going to ask you if a college education is worth the time, money, and effort. Give me 30 seconds on Jerome Powell. Does the president have the power to fire him?
He does not. Powell can only be fired for cause. Now, the only thing people would say, well, if he's completely incompetent, that would be cause. While I don't agree with everything that Powell has done, I don't think he has shown where he could be fired for cause. And one thing that the research is very clear, that central banks that are independent of the politicians are much more successful at controlling inflation than central banks which are controlled by politicians. So I think it's important that we protect the independence of the Fed as much as possible.
We're talking to Michael Miller, who also offered an opinion on, is a college degree still worth the time, money, investment? We'll get his answer to that in a minute. He's an economist. Let's keep it rolling, though, on the Wintrust Business Lunch with Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Chicago's Fulton Market will be the home of a new hospitality staffing company. New York-based HMG Plus will use the location to train workers for careers in the hospitality industry. Crane says the company is opening a 3,600-square-foot training hub next month at 1621 West Walnut. The space will include a fully equipped event training space. The workers trained by HMG either stay on with the company and work at client events or go on to jobs in restaurants or corporate hospitality. About 200 people are expected to be onboarded in the Chicago Hub's first year. Citadel CEO Ken Griffin, a billionaire formerly of Chicago and supporter of President Trump, says Trump's trade war is hurting America's standing in the world and eroding the nation's brand. He spoke at an economic summit in Washington and says traders are concerned about investments in the United States, particularly treasury bonds. Griffin says Trump's tariffs have destroyed faith that America will remain a trusted and rational actor in global financial markets. Griffin now lives in Miami. He was a prolific philanthropic donor in Chicago and is a big Republican Party donor as well. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Here comes my big break, the business of food with Steve Alexander.
Yeah, thank you, and it's a most wonderful time of the year. It's tulip time.
Yep, the town is getting ready. The tulips are starting to bloom.
The town she's talking about is Holland, Michigan, which has its annual Tulip Time Festival beginning May 2nd. Here in Chicago, it isn't quite prime time yet for the annual Tulip Palooza on Michigan Avenue.
They're trying their darndest, but they're not there yet.
That's our tulip correspondent, John Williams.
You can see the colors, but you can tell we're a few days away from full bloom.
Yeah, that seems to be the case at the many tulip farms around the area, including Richardson's Adventure Farm in Spring Grove, where the tulips are a little tardy.
Yeah, this is about 1 week later than last year, as far as when our tulips are ready.
More tulip talk after I talk about the Chevy Silverado. There's never been a better time to put a Silverado in your toolbox. Find out how at ChevyDrivesChicago.com. And maybe pack up the family and head to Spring Grove, Illinois, north of Chicago, near the Wisconsin border, where
it's really feeling like spring.
And it's looking like it, too. George Richardson says a million tulips are just starting what will be a 3 to 4 week bloom. The first 150,000 or so will be ready for Saturday, which is opening weekend for the farm. And then
by the following weekend, probably the first 100,000 will be finishing, but another few 100,000 will be coming on.
Mandy says another week or two after that will bring the rest of the million tulips the Richardsons planted on their farm. George and his family have really leaned into agritourism over the last decade. They used to be regular farmers, raising corn and pigs until going year-round in the tourism business, with tulips in the spring and sunflower fields in the summer and corn mazes and pumpkin patches in the fall and Christmas trees in the winter. But George?
Yes, sir.
Do you miss the pigs?
No, I do not miss the pigs.
Richardson's Adventure Farm, one of the many places you can ooh and ah while looking at tulips over the next few weeks.
Everybody walks around with just the biggest smile on their face. Like, wow, it's just a feast for the eyes.
How to get there and more at RichardsonAdventureFarm.com. On the food calendar, it's National Pigs in a Blanket Day. I'm Steve Alexander. That's the Business of Food on 720 WGN.
Michael Miller, an economics professor at Western Washington University, is on the line. Michael, you asked this question. Now, why don't you answer it? Is a college degree still a worthy investment?
You know, I have good news. The answer is yes. It has been true for the past 30 years that the return on college, when you take into account the direct cost, out-of-pocket cost, which would be tuition plus, books and so forth, and then what is called the opportunity cost, which you can't do, which is work. If you compare the benefits to the cost, the rate of return on college is 12.5%. Now, I don't know if that sounds high or low, but I'll tell you what. If you invest in stocks, it's somewhere between 8 and 10. If you invest in bonds, it's about 4%. So there is little doubt that based upon these findings, that college is still a really good investment.
What do you mean 12.5%? If I spend $100,000 on an education, then I'm going to come out ahead $125,000 or something?
Well, the rate of return. So if I, for every $1, yes, you're correct. Looking at it over the long term. Now, understand, of course, all the expenses of college are borne in the first 4 years, and then you reap the benefits for all the years afterwards. So they took a look at what was interesting. They say that the cost of college, the out-of-pocket cost of college, has actually fallen recently, because what they look at is the average tuition at four-year schools, both private and public, and they subtract from that all the aid that people get from the college itself, like discounts to come as a freshman, mm-hmm. As well as federal and state aid. And it turns out that you may find this number hard to believe, but they've run the figures and they're looking at the financial aid. The average total cost of 4 years of college is $30,000.
Per year or?
No, total. Total. $30,000. Because you have to understand, the average 4 year, the average tuition is $21,000, but the average student gets $15,000 in assistance of some kind.
Yeah.
So you see, that really dramatically changes it. Now, here's the other thing: the true cost of going to college is not so much the tuition and books and so forth; it's the lost opportunity that you're not working. And over the 4 years that you're not working, where you would be in high, you would have a high school degree, you would go get a job that a high school graduate would get, the lost wages in this calculation is $150,000, which means the total cost of college is the 30 in terms of out-of-pocket plus the 150 lost, or $180,000. What is astounding, or maybe not to me as an economist, but to most people, is that the opportunity cost, that lost wage, is considerably larger than the actual out-of-pocket cost that you impose.
Yeah, I see that. But what about the person who is in a trade? If you're a plumber or a carpenter, you're making good money right out of high school. Are you comparing a college education earnings to people who don't have a college education?
They're actually being very average here. What they do is they take the median college graduate. So we take the median, doesn't make sure that we don't have something like petroleum engineers skewing the numbers for college earnings. But, you know, there are, like you say, the trades make very good money, and some other people coming out of high school do not make much money. The wage premium between, say, a college graduate and a high school graduate after the college person has graduated is about $30,000 per year. So, I mean, that's a substantial amount of premium. And understand then, you kind of earn this extra $30,000 year after year after year after year. So in going to college, you impose on yourself these very large out-of-pocket and opportunity costs, but then you reap the benefits over the next 40 or 50 years. Now, of course, they properly discount that, you know, make sure that $30,000 10 years from now is not worth as much as $30,000 tomorrow. But they take into account all of that. But still, college education, it's the way to go. Now, here's the thing, though. You don't finish college, you're not that much better off. And, you know, a lot of people do start college.
Yeah.
And they incur lots of, they take out lots of loans, and that's, I don't want to say sad, but that's what happens.
Well, I'll say sad.
We really would like the people to be persistent, and or students to be persistent in going to school and trying to, you know, work it out. And because the benefit of not, the benefits that you reap for college only come with the sheepskin once you actually have the degree in hand. So there's the person coming out of with only some college will make about the same as only a little bit more than, say, somebody in high school. And
actually,
you are correct. There's lots of people within that, within the non-college, who are in the trades making really good money.
Yeah, right. Well, I think it's interesting you say this. We're out of time, but I think the current environment has cast a shadow on the value of a college education for a variety of reasons. I'm glad that
right.
you are at least putting it in that economic perspective. That's what Michael Miller does. He's an economics professor, Western Washington University. We'll call you again, Michael.
Hi, anytime, John. I love talking to you.